WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. America's healthcare system is totally out of whack, according to Donald Bartlett and James Steele. The Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative team has written a new book called Critical Condition: How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bartlett and Steele about how a system that was largely not-for-profit has become a field where the profit motive and market forces affect most decisions. And we remember comic Rodney Dangerfield. He died yesterday at the age of 82. We'll listen back to an interview from earlier this year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The CIA has released a report saying that Iraq had no stockpiles of chemical or biological weapons and no nuclear weapons capability when the U.S. invaded in March of 2003. NPR's Mike Schuster reports on today's Senate testimony by the top U.S. weapons inspector, Charles Delfer.
The conclusions of this report today directly contradict the suggestions and the claims of the Bush administration in the run-up to the war in 2003, in which they strongly suggested that there were nuclear weapons and other prohibited weapons in Iraq, and that Saddam Hussein either would use them against the United States, its allies, or give them to terrorists. And so opponents of the war and of the administration will use those conclusions to attack the administration for sure. The president and his supporters are bound to focus on the extensive part of the report that said that Saddam Hussein never abandoned his intention to get these weapons, and it's likely that they will continue to allege that that constituted a threat.
NPR's Mike Schuster. President Bush told supporters in Pennsylvania and Michigan today that his Democratic challenger would make the world less safe. And the president said Senator John Kerry's policies represent a defeat in the war on terrorism. The Kerry campaign responded that the president was growing desperate after receiving negative reviews of his performance in the first debate. They also accused the president of attempting to take a mulligan, a golfing term for a do-over, and make points that he had failed to make in the debate. Kerry was in Colorado and Missouri today preparing for his next encounter with the president on Friday. Afghanistan's interim president, Hamid Karzai, has appealed to thousands of Taliban to join his country's mainstream political life. He says he's opposed to hardcore militants, but the rest of the country's citizens should have the same rights as everyone else. NPR's Philip Reeves reports from western Afghanistan.
The appeal came on the final day of campaigning before Afghans have their first ever chance to directly elect a president. It's been a strangely quiet campaign. But Karzai ended with a flourish by appearing before an enthusiastic crowd at the National Stadium in Kabul. One of his better-known rivals, Abdul Rashid Dostum, a regional commander with a strong following among the Uzbeks of Afghanistan's north, also ventured into the capital and, at a rally, sought to display his soldierly qualities by clambering onto a horse. The threat of violence hangs over these events, though, and was underscored anew. Karzai's running mate, vice presidential candidate Ahmed Zia Massoud, narrowly escaped a bomb which struck his convoy in the northeast. The Taliban claimed responsibility. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Herat.
In stocks, the Dow gained 62 points to close at 10,240 in active trading. This is NPR News. The U.S. military in Iraq says a suicide car bomber killed 16 Iraqis and injured about 30 when he blew himself up at an Iraqi military checkpoint northwest of Baghdad. The car bomb attack took place at an Iraqi National Guard camp. Mount St. Helens has settled down over the past 24 hours, allowing scientists to scale back an alert for a dangerous eruption. Lee Garnett reports from Oregon Public Broadcasting.
The volcano has emitted 5 steam blasts since activity began 2 weeks ago, but after the latest Tuesday morning, small earthquakes have not returned as they did before. Federal geologist Willie Scott says the development allows officials to relax their alert.
We no longer think that an eruption is imminent in the sense of minutes or hours. of an event that would endanger life and property.
But Scott cautions that seismic activity could return at any time, and he predicts the volcanic episode is not over yet. He says the pause will allow scientists more time to analyze data from instruments positioned inside the crater. He says recent rainfall set off at least one mudslide, and though more slides are likely, they're not dangerous to the public. For NPR News, I'm Lee Garnett in Portland.
The Senate has approved a measure that calls for wide-ranging changes to the nation's intelligence community. The legislation was created in response to the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. It would create a national counterterrorism center and would place most of the nation's intelligence services under a single national director. The House is expected to take up similar legislation sometime this week. In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 15 points to close at 1971. The S&P 500 was up 7 to 1,142. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Their new book examines what's gone wrong with America's healthcare industry. It's called Critical Condition: How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. They write, American healthcare has become a lottery. If you work for a large company that provides generous benefits, you win. If you work for a small company or as an independent contractor, you lose. These are the lucky ones, the ones who have health insurance. Beyond them are 44 million others, their numbers growing, who do not. Bartlett and Steele have worked together for three decades, first at the Philadelphia Inquirer and since 1997 as editors at large for Time magazine. They've won two Pulitzer Prizes and two National Magazine Awards. Their book, America, What Went Wrong, was on the bestseller list for 8 months. I think there's a general perception that people are paying more for health insurance, paying more for their drugs, and that in some ways they're getting less, that there's more restrictions being placed on what their insurance will reimburse them for. Is that an accurate perception?
There's no question about that. When you look at what we spend, I mean, the numbers are so large they don't mean anything to people, $1.7 trillion. But what should mean something to people is we spend twice as much on healthcare per capita than, say, Greece, France, Italy, Spain, Japan. And the people in those countries and a lot of other countries live a lot longer than we do. So there's something clearly amiss here.
Well, when people complain about the rising costs of health insurance and of drugs and everything, the answer we usually get is, well, there are so many new procedures and so many new drugs that we didn't have before, and the research is expensive. Those high-tech imaging diagnostic tools we use are very expensive, and those costs are passed on to us, and that's why we're paying more. Is that an accurate analysis of why we're paying more, James Steele?
That's the most common description you hear. You're absolutely right, Terry. I mean, you hear that everywhere. You read it everywhere. We put a much higher priority on procedures rather than care. I mean, that's one of the big problems in this country, and as a result of that, we're very much into the latest bit of technology. We're very much into the latest pill that comes down the track. We're very much into the latest medical process by which we think we'll solve the situation. But we don't deal with basic care in this country, which is the reason why we think, in part, our life expectancy here is lower than almost every other developed country. So that doesn't do it. The other thing, which we think is at the root of it, and this was what we found so fascinating, that much of the turmoil in healthcare, much of the problems, so much of what we see out there is a direct result of the decision the country made over basically about three decades ago to go for market-based, for-profit health care. I mean, the whole purpose of this supposedly was to bring business methods, efficiencies to health care. And the reason we embraced this back in the early 80s was that at the time health care costs were rising very rapidly, and they were at the time roughly 11% of our gross domestic product. Now, here we are, 25 years later plus, and they're at 15.3 and still going up. So the whole experiment has not worked, but at the same time, billions of dollars have flowed out of the system that have had nothing whatsoever to do with healthcare, done nothing whatsoever to really substantially improve patient care, but they've been a wonderful boon for Wall Street, a wonderful thing for investors who got in on the ground floor of many of those companies.
By focusing on a market-based system, what we've done is reward procedures. We don't reward good care. We pay someone for doing procedures. And that's really the worst kind of healthcare system imaginable.
What do you mean by that, that we reward the doctor for performing procedures?
Well, it's like you indicated the latest test, the latest diagnostic test. The more tests you do, the more surgeries you perform.
How does that reward doctors?
Well, they're getting paid for the procedure. And one of the real sad aspects of what's happened to healthcare system in this country is the demise of the family practitioner, the general practitioner. And I know a lot of people think, well, I'm not going to feel sorry for doctors and their salaries, but the fact of the matter is family practitioners get paid embarrassingly little in this country. It's the doctor who does the procedure who is doing reasonably well. And the more high-tech surgery, the better off. But what this has done is create, it's not a healthcare system, it's basically a medical industrial complex in which the money is flowing to an industry, not an entity that's actually treating or caring for people. The other aspect of it is that we talk about is that we spend nothing on preventive care. And that's really where ultimately where the real benefits are going to come for society as a whole, not on treating people.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Donald Bartlett and James Steele, two investigative reporters, and their new book is on the healthcare industry and what's wrong with it. It's called Critical Condition. So much of your book is about the turning of the healthcare industry into a for-profit industry, you know, including hospitals, of course. And you trace the kind of for-profit emphasis of, say, hospitalization to the 1980s, the early 1980s, and the Reagan administration. What was the turning point there in the era of the so-called Reagan Revolution in changing the healthcare system?
Well, the irony that the turning point then was not unlike some of the problems we have now, which was that costs were going up. People were trying to look around for a way to restrain those costs. And everybody said, government can't do this. Private industry can do it. It has the efficiency. We need business methods to bring some sanity out of this. And that's why we need to go with the for-profit model. At the time, there had been any number of experiments in HMOs. It's hard to think. HMOs now are like a bad word in most of America. But ironically, in the beginning, they were seen as a very positive force, as a way to provide a lot of this overall care without being outrageously expensive. But by the early 80s, many of these had been converted from not-for-profit to for-profit models, which had made many of the original founders and stockholders a lot of money. So the idea was business methods. And what we found was, when we looked at this whole issue, and in the beginning that made so much sense to people, but if you look at it over time, healthcare isn't like any other business. And I think that's the thing that everybody underestimated at the time and didn't see properly. It's not like selling automobiles or televisions or apparel where you want a competitive situation where you can go into a store and see what's the cheapest thing here. You can't really do that with healthcare. It's not the same kind of an animal. Also, in most business, you want to sell more of the product. You want to sell more cars. You want to sell more clothing. You want to sell more TVs. Do we want to sell more healthcare? Probably not. We need to manage it better, and that's what we haven't done.
So what exactly did the Reagan administration do in the early 1980s that changed healthcare?
They basically privatized the HMOs. They put the message out. They made various arrangements with brokerage houses to promote the process. They sent the message out that for-profit, privately run hospitals would be certainly encouraged. That government would play less of a role in the lives of healthcare. That was the message out there.
So what kind of federal funding had existed that was cut
back? Well,
that's
what people tend to forget because so many years have passed. The HMOs initially were funded by the federal government, and it was a very small amount of money, and they actually started out doing reasonably well. But once they converted the HMO to a for-profit business, then the marketplace took over. And we're not anti-market. I mean, the market works wonderfully, as Jim indicated. If you're selling cars or cereal or cosmetics or whatever, that works fine. But in healthcare, you don't want to be selling more of a product. You want to either manage it or you want to sell less. The ideal healthcare system would be one in which, you know, people really, very few people need any drugs of any kind, and people are living long without surgical procedures. That would be the ideal. And the way you achieve that, in part at least, is through preventive care, not through treatment. But the for-profit system, obviously that runs counter to what underpins the profit system.
You've looked at, are there other big government changes, federal policy and funding changes after the Reagan administration that set us on the course that we're on now?
The basic thing that happened really in the early 80s was it was not so much a funding thing per se, so much as it was cutting off funds to the existing federally sponsored or encouraged, we should say, agencies. There were other things all throughout the 80s and 90s. I mean, some of the big ones were antitrust rulings that certainly encouraged the consolidation of the private hospitals into HCA, the Hospital Corporation of America, predated the 80s. But in the 80s on, they had a tremendous incentive to get bigger and bigger and bigger, which they've since done. The same thing with Tenet, the second largest hospital chain. And what happened with this, it wasn't so much a direct policy after that occurred, but the message was there, look, Washington wants private industry, the market, to determine things in hospitals. We want to be more efficient. We want to run better. And, of course, anybody who's ever been in a hospital or looked at a hospital or even taken a cursory look at healthcare knows what a chaotic field it is. I mean, even in the best of circumstances, there's just so many different aspects to it. So that hit home even with people who otherwise would have been sympathetic. So all of those things happened, including some, I know, antitrust rulings, I believe, in the early 90s encouraged that process. But it was more just that general
These
view.
Are antitrust rulings that made it less likely that you would be punished for violating antitrust laws.
Right.
They loosened the regulations.
They loosened things and it encouraged the formation of bigger companies in that sense. But the most important thing was just an overall encouragement of the market. And what happened in healthcare was very similar to a lot of things in the economy at the time. We were told that businesses run better if they pay more attention to how they've done the last week or month or whatever. I mean, the bottom line orientation of business from the 80s on, that business school model was very powerful. So a lot of that is just part of what happened in healthcare. But the difference is healthcare just wasn't like these other industries, and that's why it just has failed so miserably.
You point out that the efficiency model that some hospitals borrowed from industries hasn't really worked in the hospital setting. Can you give us an example or two of something that was borrowed from the efficiency model of industry applied to the hospital and it's not working?
I know exactly what you're talking about. This was one of those eye-openers that we came across when this whole efficiency market-based medicine began to take over. A number of consulting companies studied the auto industry, or they took certain processes that had been developed in the auto industry, first-in-time inventory, total quality management, a whole range of these things, and began to apply them to hospitals. One of the things that clearly didn't work was the concept of just-in-time inventory. This was a concept that was embraced by manufacturing, particularly auto plants. The idea was you didn't have excess bolts and fenders and things of that sort sitting around in a warehouse. You tried to keep a continuous stream of things going into the production of your cars. And this was adopted by other industries as well.
So you don't order it until you really need it.
You don't order it until you really need it. And the idea was you will do the same thing in hospitals. We won't spend X amount of money on things that we don't need yet. And it's great with cars, of course, because if you do run a little short, while it may affect your production, it's certainly not a life-threatening issue. But in a hospital, if you're suddenly running out of sutures or a medical pump or some other device that you need in a very critical situation, the lack of the proper inventory is an extremely serious matter.
And you've seen that happen.
And we've talked to nurses who have been in operating rooms where suddenly there weren't the proper materials or things were missing, that they actually had to have a patient wired up to equipment for a period of time until the missing part was then brought in and let the surgeon continue the procedure.
My guests are Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Their new book about the healthcare industry is called Critical Condition. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Donald Bartlett and James Steele. This investigative team has won two Pulitzer Prizes. Their new book is called Critical Condition: How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. There seem to be so many contradictory forces at work right now. Because, you know, on the one hand, you're saying doctors are rewarded for performing certain high-tech procedures. On the other hand, doctors are being warned not to perform a lot of high-tech procedures unless it's absolutely necessary because the price of the procedure is so high. So do those two things balance each other out or what?
Your point is absolutely right in terms of these contradictory forces. I mean, one of the most bizarre things we ran across is that the one health plan that would pay for Viagra on one hand but would not pay for a woman's birth control pills. So it's like, what is going on here? I mean, there should be some kind of consistency there. But you see that throughout healthcare. One of the things that just amazed us about the research in this was there are things in medicine we had no idea in healthcare. And one of them is anytime you go see a doctor and you come out with a billing sheet, there'll be these little 5-digit codes about whatever they did, general office visit, immunization, whatever it is. This has become this battleground in healthcare between insurers and many doctors around the country, because many doctors will see additional things when they're in there, and they'll check off several of these, and they feel they should be paid for them because they've spent more time with the patient and they brought their expertise and knowledge to bear, which seems fair as it can be to us. But when it goes to the insurers, very often the 3 or 4 things they've checked, which would lead to more payment, are boiled into one category. It's a complicated term in the industry called downcoding, but this goes on all over the country, and there are now computer programs that the insurers use to compress the billing of doctors. And it's been a tremendous source of loss of revenue to many doctors who are not salaried but who depend on their fees, depend on their reimbursements. And it's just typical of one of these things that's going on behind the scenes that the average patient has no knowledge of, but which is impacting on their health and certainly impacting on the way their doctors view the profession.
So the bureaucracy is basically deciding what the doctor gets paid for when he makes a diagnosis.
Sure. And it's also impacting the way you're treated.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going in for and the doctor is looking down at that sheet with all those codes on it, and he sees that he can do 2 or 3 at once, he's not going to do it in many cases because he's only going to get paid for one. But if he brings you back 3 times, he will get paid for the 3 separate procedures. This is nonsensical. This is not good business. It's not. It's just bad medicine, bad economics.
And you point out in your book that there's a whole new profession that has grown around the new healthcare system, and it's the medical bureaucracy. How much of our healthcare dollars is actually going to fund this huge bureaucracy?
Some studies have put it at nearly $1 out of $3. To the administrative costs to just run this system. And again, this is one of the ironies of our embrace of this market-based free market medicine from the 80s, because supposedly all of this was to make everything more efficient. But what's happened with this is with the emphasis on competition, multiple insurers, multiple providers, there are literally thousands of plans out there that provide various things. I mean, the average doctor's office anymore, they have to have a staff of people processing these things, because it can mean money out of their pocket unless they're properly overseeing that whole process. So the bureaucracy is everything from the doctor's office to the insurer on up the line. I mean, how many of us have spent time calling call centers for various things, that a simple referral to find out has that been faxed to the doctor? That's all part of the process, which is essentially aimed to, like in many cases, to discourage care. But the fact of the matter is it leads to this huge administrative overlay, because they're not defined billings and what we pay for things.
Now, some people who are particularly skeptical or cynical believe that sometimes they are intentionally overbilled, or that doctors are intentionally underpaid, under-reimbursed, in the hopes that, that the company is hoping that you're not going to take the time to call and argue with this, and that if you don't take the time, they're going to gain that extra money because they overbilled you. How cynical are these people who think that?
I don't think they're cynical at all. There's no question this is going on. The reason is you can't have this happening over and over and over again, as it does, unless it is deliberate.
Give me an example of the problem.
Well, they'll deny a payment for a procedure that is clearly covered under a policy in the hope that the person will then submit a check and pay for it. A smart consumer will challenge it. And here's the problem with this. Nobody has time to do this. If you're working a full-time job, you do not have time to spend on the telephone. And this is really significant time. Those of us who are lucky enough to have a stay-at-home wife who will man the phone and stay on that phone and say, I want to talk to your supervisor, and then I want to talk to your supervisor, will in the end ultimately win because they're right. But most people don't have the time. They can't spend that kind of time getting what should be an honest answer.
Donald Bartlett and James Steele will be back in the second half of the show. Their new book about the healthcare industry is called Critical Condition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delacorte Press, publisher of Da Vinci Decoded, Discovering the Spiritual Secrets of Leonardo's Seven Principles by Michael J. Gelb, from American Jewish World Service, in support of NPR's expanding coverage of Africa. Information about AJWS-funded projects at ajws.org. And by Gotham Books, publishers of Almost French by Sarah Turnbull, based on the true story of one woman who finds adventure and the love of her life in Paris. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Bartlett and Steele offer a proposal for improving the healthcare system. And we remember comic and actor Rodney Dangerfield. He died yesterday at the age of 82.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative team of Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Their new book is about the healthcare industry. It's called Critical Condition: How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. Have you seen a system that you think worked that we should be learning from?
We studied just briefly some of the foreign systems and the Canadian system, and I think the first thing we should say is that there isn't any healthcare system anywhere in the world that's, to our way of thinking, a model. Every one of them has certain kinds of flaws.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that stands out with most of systems elsewhere, and the Canadian, certainly the French, the German system, the Italian system, is that everybody is covered. So if something happens to you, you're not having to face the possibility that you might lose your house, lose your savings, in some other way face financial ruin, which can happen in this country if you do not have insurance. That's the main thing those other systems have done, which we have not done, and which we've refused to do. Everybody pounds the Canadian system in this country, not everybody, but a lot of people are always pointing their long waits up there as though there aren't waits in this country anymore, which there are. Not everywhere, but in many jurisdictions. But they've provided a floor of coverage, which goes a long way toward taking care of most Canadians in terms of their basic health needs. And it's not a surprise to us that Canadians live longer than we do.
There was a recent study, just on that point Jim's talking about, that attributed 18,000 deaths in one recent year to people who really needed medical attention but wouldn't seek it because they didn't have the money. And there's one of the glib responses you often hear is nobody needs to go without health care in this country. Anybody who walks into an emergency room, anyone, anywhere will be treated. There's a certain amount of truth in that. But what it ignores is there's a fairly nice segment of the population that sincerely believes, you know, that they need to pay their own way and as a consequence won't get help.
You know, a lot of people say, do you really want your health care in the arms of the government?
We thought about this a lot. Okay, what are you going to do? There is just too much animosity toward government to come up with a government system, and not without some reason. So what is the answer then? And we thought that maybe the solution would be something like the Federal Reserve System, in which you have a quasi-independent board organization that controls all health care but is not dependent on Congress, the White House. You know, you have their staggered terms and totally independent and can free to make decisions without having to worry about what Congress is going to say about funding. It has a lot of merit, we think, for not just paying the bills or collecting the money or making sure everybody's covered, but doing the kinds of medical research now that are not done in this country, looking at preventive medicine. You mentioned, you know, the test business. Tests are conducted here willy-nilly without anybody, no independent authority looking at the tests and saying, are these worth the money? Are we getting our money's worth in these tests? Are we getting any really good medical results from these tests? This is especially true with drugs. And an independent organization like this could do the studies that nobody can do today without a vested interest. And the vested interest part of this is really critical because whether it's research into diseases, treatment of diseases or drugs or whatever, there are so many vested interests now that there is really no pure research out there anymore.
For example, a lot of the research is funded by the pharmaceutical companies.
Exactly.
Right. And one of the things that, you know, we don't have any illusions about people. A lot of people will certainly attack the book because it's saying all you want is another big government agency, mm-hmm. which is not what this is calling for in any way. But what's interesting is that even attitudes within the profession clearly are starting to change on this. And one of the most revealing studies that we came across and which we deal with in the book was there's an institution in Washington called the Center for Studying Health System Change, and they've been around a long time, and they poll and they interview people and they see where folks are at on various issues. And every 2 years, they go out and they survey doctors, nurses, insurers, and other professionals in selected big cities across the country. Their study in 2004 turned out to be a real eye-opener to them because, for the first time, they had people talking about people who previous to that had just had their basic faith in the private system saying, this is not working. This whole thing is a mess. And one of them said in particular, one surprise benefit consultant reported in the study, there is now a lack of resistance to government involvement. People are starting to see that the government is going to have to be involved here. It may not necessarily mean running everything, but it means at least establishing some standards, at least providing some overall guidelines, because it's not functioning the way everybody thought it would 25 years ago when we embraced this wholeheartedly.
My guests are Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Their new book about the healthcare industry is called Critical Condition. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Donald Bartlett and James Steele, and their new book is an assessment of the healthcare industry. It's called Critical Condition. Now, let me ask you a question about Vioxx, which is now going to be taken off the market because the latest study found that it seems to cause in a small but significant percentage of people who take it a heart attack. And I'm wondering, what's the moral of that story for you?
In some ways, the Vioxx story really symbolizes everything that's wrong in the prescription drug field. This was a drug for arthritis, basically. They wanted to expand it into another area, which is very common, called off-label prescriptions. Off-label prescriptions are a huge field because then the pharmaceutical company doesn't have to go through the process of running tests to get FDA approval. They just encourage doctors to use it, whatever that drug may be. But in this case,
and off-label is it's not what the drug was officially created for.
Exactly.
But it can treat this other condition.
Right.
There is some reason to believe that people benefit from its use for another condition. But in Merck's case, they wanted FDA approval for this, and that's how this test or drug trial came about, and Vioxx flunked. Because it was a much longer term trial than they had originally for the approval for the arthritis treatment. But here you have a case of a drug which has been sold the way most drugs are today on television with celebrity spokespeople. And in Vioxx's case, it's Dorothy Hamill, the skater, who was also identified as one of the most trusted sports figures. This is the way we sell healthcare today, or market medicine, encouraging people to take products that they may or may not need. Doctors are always available to write the prescriptions, and doctors complain as a result of the advertising that they feel under pressure to write prescriptions they would not normally write if the patient comes in with a specific request. And so in some ways, Vioxx represents everything that's wrong out there. We're marketing drugs. We're not marketing treatment for a condition. We're creating a market-driven demand for a product. And there's none more, probably the best example are the erectile dysfunction drugs out there. Was there a demand for three different drugs to treat what prior to their appearance in the market was called impotence, but now you've got to have a new name. You have to have a new name, one that's going to fly in advertising circles. You have the hyped market of tens of millions of men who need this. Not likely. So what is the real market? Well, we found in talking to people, one of the markets is guys in their 20s who want to drink heavily and have sex. That's not what healthcare is about. It's not what it should be about. It's one reason we have high costs. Money's being spent on research that we really don't really need. And it's one of the reasons we look at this, you know, this kind of proposal we've made for this overall system to just do pure research, what's going to help the most number, the largest number of people.
A couple of questions about malpractice insurance.
Mm-hmm.
I know of at least a couple of doctors who have either given up their practice or had to move either to a new city or, a new kind of practice because their malpractice insurance was so high. And it's not because they had any problems. It's just because rates for their particular specialty in their particular geographical location were sky high. And some people say, yes, that's a problem because the trial lawyers are greedy and they're asking for, you know, incredibly high, payments when they win lawsuits. Other people have their own explanations for why rates are so high. Based on the evidence that you've gotten, why is malpractice so high right now?
It's a little bit of both on those. Pennsylvania is a really good example of this because it's, depending on who you talk to, either first or second in the country in terms of a malpractice litigation. But the other half of that equation that no one talks about is this. Pennsylvania also has the largest number of bad doctors who are not disciplined by the state. And so you have more people out there practicing medicine who shouldn't be in Pennsylvania than in most other states.
Why aren't they disciplined?
For whatever reason, the state just doesn't look into bad doctors in Pennsylvania. It just does not happen. There's a massive database down in Washington that tracks every malpractice, every complaint, every infraction reported by a hospital about a doctor. This was supposed to be another one of those great consumer items, except the name of the doctor is kept secret. But you can look at that and see how many are from Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania's at the top, near the top. And this is one explanation for high malpractice here. There are more bad doctors. Then you do have frivolous lawsuits. There's no question that goes on. But the idea that you can put a cap on there, which a lot of people favor, of $250,000, what do you say to the woman we write about in the book who had both breasts lopped off? $250,000, that's it?
She didn't have cancer, it turned out.
No.
Right.
Absolutely not.
So that was a mistake. The double mastectomy was a complete mistake.
Complete mistake. Is that $250,000? If it was my wife, it wouldn't be.
Malpractice also varies fairly significantly from state to state. There are many, many states where it's not the issue that it is in states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey. I think New York State is actually the state with the largest awards in this area, if I'm not mistaken. But so it varies from state to state. And even states that have placed a cap on things, it hasn't shown any particularly marked increase in the quality of the health care. I mean, California's had a cap for a long time. And the system in California, if anything, is in worse shape than almost any other state,
right,
just in terms of basic inability to deliver health care, constant turmoil, salaries going down, doctors chronically upset, and with good reason. So it's one piece of that whole equation. And if you're in a state where it's been a big issue, where you know a doctor, it's a tremendous issue. But overall, we have to deal also with the issue of catastrophic coverage. I mean, that's what's part of it, too. I mean, a lot of the litigation is because an accident has happened in one way or another, and there's no way to take care of that person other than the insurance route. I mean, that is another thing that could also be dealt with in the kind of thing we propose at the end, you know, with true catastrophic coverage.
I mean, so it would be covered. So if an error was made, your health costs would be covered by your medical insurance and
right,
not by the lawsuit.
Not by the lawsuit, exactly.
You would take that off the table.
Right.
Right. Well, I want to thank you both very much.
Nice to be with you, Terry.
Donald Bartlett and James Steele are editors at large for Time Magazine. Their new book is called Critical Condition. And now we're going to remember Rodney Dangerfield. The comic and actor died yesterday at the age of 82. Dangerfield created his persona around his signature line.
One of my problems, I don't get no respect. No respect at all. Every time I get in an elevator, the operator says the same thing to me. Basement? I mean, no respect. Well, the other day, I was standing in front of a big apartment house. The doorman asked me to get him a cab. Same thing with my friends, no respect. My friends tell me when I call them on a phone, I should use a certain signal. I should let it ring twice, hang up, and don't call back.
Although Dangerfield never stopped complaining on stage that he got no respect, he was actually revered by many younger comics, not only for his stand-up comedy, but for his performances in such movies as Caddyshack, Back to School, and Natural Born Killers. Jim Carrey wrote the introduction for Dangerfield's book, It's Not Easy Being Me, which was published a few months ago. I spoke with Dangerfield in July, and his voice sounded weak, which wasn't surprising considering the health problems he'd faced in the past 4 years, including heart bypass surgery, a heart attack, and surgery to bypass clogged arteries in his brain. Nevertheless, Dangerfield told me he hoped to perform again. Here's an excerpt of our interview. Rodney Dangerfield, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, I got to ask you, you know, your comedy is built around your most famous line, I don't get no respect. And you've said that The Godfather inspired you to come up with it. How did it come to you? Did you think of it the first time you saw The Godfather movie? Like, how did
Maybe
it actually...
Maybe not the first time, but I heard the word respect. When The Godfather came out, all you hear was, she's with me, you show her respect. I want respect. I'm with him. Okay, don't know respect, go out of your mind, you know, with respect. So I wrote a joke about respect and see what the reaction would be. Is the first joke I wrote, I was working at a place called Upstairs at the Duplex in Greenwich Village. And I told the joke, I said, first time I said, trouble me, I don't get no respect. I said, when I was a kid, they played hide and seek. They wouldn't even look for me, you know? And that was the first joke I wrote. And and the audience came over to me afterwards and said, hey, me too, Roddy, no respect. Me too, Roddy, no respect. And all of a sudden I found an image, you know? And it's been good for me.
Now, you started doing the respect stuff when you came back to show business at around the age of 40. You had left show business for around 12 years. You had a family. You needed to make money to support your family. And you went into the aluminum siding business for a while.
Right.
What was your act like the first time around?
When I quit show business, to give you an idea how well I was doing at the time I quit. I was the only one who knew I quit.
So what were the first jokes you remember telling on stage?
When I was 17 years old, I was booked by an agent named Jack Miller, who packed about 10 people in his car in New York, and we all drove out to Newark. The first joke I told out there, and it still got a laugh at me, you know? I said, look in the audience tonight, the women look like a beautiful bed of roses. Of course there's a weed here and there, you know. So that was a joke I told when I was 17.
Now, when you started performing, you didn't use the name Rodney Dangerfield. That was a name...
My legal name is Jack Roy, R-O-Y.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started performing, that was the name I used the first time in my career. When I came back the second time, then I became Rodney Dangerfield. And with a name like that, if you don't hit, you're an idiot, you know?
Now, you were born with the last name of Roy, but that Roy was actually your father's stage name. His last
That's
name,
right.
His birth name was Cohen.
His first name was Philip.
Mm-hmm.
Philip Cohen is his legal name. But he became Roy and Arthur. Arthur was my uncle, and they did a vaudeville act, you know, comedy vaudeville act.
What was the act like?
They would break plates. They would throw plates into the theater like a boomerang, and it would swing over the people's heads and come back to the stage. It was quite a feat to do it, but they did that mostly in their act. That was part of it, you know. And other than that, there was some little juggling and humor, whatever went on there, you know.
Now, I know you weren't close to your father, and he really didn't even live with the family when you were growing up, but I'm wondering if you went to see him much, if you saw his act much.
I never saw his act. I was too young, but I used to go to see him twice a year. He lived in New York, a half hour from Kew Gardens, where we lived, and I'd take a subway in, 10 years old, 12 years old, whatever it was, and I'd meet him for an hour, then he'd walk me back to the subway, and I'd go home. My father saw me 2 hours a year That's what it amounted to.
So, did it make you want to be in show business?
Who knows? I don't know. You know, show me some love. Show me some. Let me hear the laughs, the applause. I'll take love any way I can get it, you know? And I guess to, who knows, to get love, you're in show business, to try and make some money, but there's no money in it when you start, so it's just for, because you like to do it, I guess.
We're listening to an interview with Rodney Dangerfield. He died yesterday at the age of 82. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview with Rodney Dangerfield that we recorded over the summer. He died yesterday at the age of 82. It seems like you had a really rough childhood. You never got to see your father, but 2 hours a year you got to see him. You didn't really like your mother. She sounds like she was a really difficult woman.
Yeah.
Was there anything that was fun or funny in your childhood? Were there...
Nothing funny at all.
Seriously? So you think you had an unhappy childhood all the time?
Extremely. I never went to a ball game, no one took me anywhere. Being brought up with no father and a mother who was extremely selfish. Like, she never made me breakfast my entire life. Always got up 11 o'clock. But before I'd go to school, I didn't mind the newsstand for an hour and a half, that I always had the same breakfast. Orangeade, donut, and coffee. That was a home-cooked meal to me.
When you decided to get back into show business, one of the ways you did it was by opening up your own club.
Well, I'll tell you, the club was opened way after I was in show business. I was already doing okay when I opened the club,
mm-hmm.
You know. I opened the club for, one big reason was I had two small kids at home. You know, about 4 and 8, and I couldn't leave town and leave them alone. I had a domestic situation that was difficult, you know. So I decided to open a nightclub and I can be in New York or work in New York only, and my kids won't be alone, you know.
You helped a lot of comics get started at your club.
Yeah.
You want to name some of them?
Yeah, well, Jim Carrey. I met Jim, though. He worked the club, too, but I met him. I was working in Toronto. They told me to catch this fellow to think he's pretty good. And I caught him. He was doing impressions, and he was great, great. So I asked him to work with me, and the first job we went to was Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, which was a big deal for him, he told me, you know what I mean? And after that, he opened for me for 2 years on the road. So I was directly responsible to help him get in the States and everything else. Sam Kinison is one of my proteges, or was. He's a genius, Sam Kinison was. You know, he's too much, and I thought he was great, and I put him on my show twice. He was on. And Jerry...
Seinfeld?
Yeah, Jerry Seinfeld. He was on the show, too. And a lot of other, Bob Saget, Louis Anderson, Rita Rudner.
Can you talk a little bit about how you put together your act? Do jokes just come to you whole, or do you have to, like, work at them and refine them?
No, sometimes you hit one right off the bat. It's funny, boom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you contrive. You got to sit and write one. Like, I wrote a joke, you know, the other day. It was in the book, I think, you know. I'm getting old. I had an accident. I was arrested for hit and walk.
Did your mother ever see you perform? Did she live to see you become very successful?
No. My father did. In fact, I flew him up here from Florida to come to the club and spend a night or two in the apartment with me. So he flew up there. He saw my whatever success I had at the time.
Did your relationship change when he saw how successful you were?
No, I don't think that had nothing to do with it. Our relationship changed because I became older, and I forgave him for everything. He cried to me, and he said, "Will you forgive me?" He meant for never seeing me, never, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
2 hours a year, I told him. And knowing my mother, he couldn't have been happy with her, you know. I liked my father better as a person, you know.
You write in your book that your father's funeral was one of the loneliest moments of your life.
Yeah, right.
And that you were the only
one
there.
I was there alone, you know?
Yeah, you were the only one at the funeral.
And as they were lowering his body into the ground, one of the workers comes over to me and says, "Hey, Rodney, can I have your autograph?" What timing, you know?
Having built so much of your career on this don't get no respect image, do you realize how appreciated you are now in comedy? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I in my own head, though, you see, I can never be a big shot. And I just, like if I check in a hotel and the bellhop grabs my bag, I feel like I should be taking the bag, you know? And, but I appreciate the fact that I'm popular with people. It's a very nice feeling. Rather to be unpopular. So I'm happy about the way things went.
Rodney Dangerfield recorded in July. He died yesterday at the age of 82 of complications after heart valve replacement surgery. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From Warner Home Video, presenting the 10th anniversary DVD release of The Shawshank Redemption, a two-disc special edition DVD with all new extra features. And by Harcourt, publishers of Jose Saramago's new novel, The Double, a meditation on identity by the author of Blindness. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings, and Dan Rather on the coverage of the war and the election and the controversy over the 60-minute story on the president's National Guard service. This panel discussion was recorded at last weekend's New Yorker Festival and was moderated by New Yorker writer Ken Auletta. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.